It's the fourth rock from the sun, the red planet, and we know more about it now by a lot than we did a decade ago, thanks in part to a spacecraft called Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. We talked to its project scientist, Rich Zurich, coming up now. It's all new and all blue, except for the red part. Join us. Nolan, Mars is the most intensively explored planet other than our own. 44 missions have been sent to explore the red planet, and 17 have been reasonably successful. The United States has been triumphant with the twin Viking landers in the 1970s, the Mars Pathfinder, which was featured famously in the movie The Martian, and the Sojourner rover in the 90s. The twin rovers, Spirit and Curiosity, in the 2000s, and of course, Curiosity rover, which is now moving around on Mars and Gale Crater. But there's one mission that, for me at least, really stands out as the big science payoff mission.
And what mission is that?
That is the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's been spent a decade observing Mars from above and also acting as a key communications element with the rovers. We're joined now by Rich Zurich, project scientist for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which launched in 2005 and has been exploring and making important discoveries from above the red planet for the past decade. Rich, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Can we start with something trivial?
Of course.
Why doesn't MRO have a cool name like Pathfinder or Spirit, Opportunity or Curiosity?
Well, NASA actually put a committee together to deal with this, but it got lost between a change of administrators. And you'll notice that our orbiters have more sort of workman-like names in that Mars Global Surveyor or Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And that says what we do.
Do you have like a nickname for it, though?
Sometimes we call it Mr. O from the initials, MRO.
Ah. Well, NASA has made Mars a prime target for exploration for decades now. And, you know, the mantra has been follow the water. Explain to us why Mars is the most easily explored and therefore explored planets in our solar system other than Earth.
It's easy to get to Mars in the sense of, as a planet, it's close by. And it's also a place that looks very Earth-like. We can see its surface. We can imagine ourselves standing on the surface. Our robots rove across it. And Mars is very Earth-like in many respects. The day is about the same. The area, although it's a smaller planet, is the same as the land area of the Earth. So there are many similarities. And we also think Mars was once a water world where there was water moving across its surface. Life may have gotten a foothold there about the same time as it did on Earth. It's also a place where our explorers might one day use the local resources on the planet. And it does have those.
Let's talk about the initial planning for this mission. What were the science goals setting out and the instruments that were put aboard MRO to achieve those?
Well, what we wanted to do was to follow the water in all of its forms. As a vapor in the atmosphere, to look for possibilities of liquid water on the surface, and to look for ice. Mars' atmosphere today is cold, it's thin. And that means most of the time, ice is going to sublime into gas and gas will condense back into ice. But under certain circumstances, particularly if there's salts around that can depress the freezing point, water could be a liquid too. So to see all of that, we had to have instruments that could look into the polar caps. So we had a radar. We needed the highest resolution camera that we put into deep space so we could see the details of the landforms. We need a mapping spectrometer that could tell us where the aqueous minerals, those things that were formed in water, were on the surface. Were they in the older terrain, the younger terrain? Just where they? And finally, we had to look, where's the water in the atmosphere and how does it change with season and from year to year?
And when was Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter launched, and when did it arrive at Mars?
August 12th, 2005. After a cruise of several months, it reached Mars on the 10th of March in 2006. But then we still had to aerobrake because we were in a very elliptical orbit at that time. we dipped into the atmosphere, and that brings your orbit more circular. And eventually, in November, 10 years ago, almost to the day, we started our primary science phase.
Let's go through some of Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter's greatest hits, and take your time on this. I'd like to start out with the beginning. What was one of the first big discoveries or most important things, observations that MRO made?
Well, the first thing we saw was incredible diversity. There had been sort of an assumption there might be widespread regions that were more or less made of the same stuff that would appear the same way. And what we found is there were many different kinds of environments dating all the way back to early in its history. There were minerals that had formed in water. So not just the surface morphology of channels and networks like rivers running across the planet, but the surface itself had evidence there had been a lot of water for a period of time. So that diversity was really important. And as we probed into things like the ice caps, we could see layers inside as well as the edge of this ice caps. We started to understand that Mars is still changing over time. And even geologically speaking, over the last few million years, relatively young in a planet's history, there have been ice ages, other activity, other changes on the planet. So diversity was what we saw and what we found as we poked in more detail at what the planet looked like.
And so for the first 5 years, what are some of the other interesting discoveries? And then we'll get into the past 5 years after a break.
Well, there were a lot of places that pointed to that the planet could have been habitable in those early days. It had the kinds of minerals that were present that could sustain life. We consider them important for it. And then just physically, we found things like buried in the South Polar Cap, for instance, was enough carbon dioxide ice that if it were exposed again to the atmosphere, it could double the present atmospheric pressure. So that was pretty interesting in itself. And then we've seen other things, like we saw some of these dark streaks that extended down the rugged slopes of craters or canyons and such. It happened during the warm seasons where they would extend down slope. They'd fade away when the cold weather returned. And then the whole sequence would repeat again. We were just getting a glimpse of that by the end of our first 5 years.
You're listening to Blue Dot on NSPR, and we're talking to Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter project scientist Rich Zurich about the spacecraft's decade-long exploration of the Red Planet. We'll be back after a short break. And we're back talking to Rich Zurich, project scientist for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. He joins us from the studios at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Let's talk about the past 5 years. What are some of the most important discoveries we've made recently?
Well, the longevity of the mission, the fact that we've lasted more than 5 years, and the precision of the measurements, the spatial resolution and such, means that we've been able to see that Mars is changing today. Sand dunes move. There are ice blocks that fall off the edge of the polar caps. There are places like these recurring slope lineae, that is these dark streaks that extend down and repeat from Mars year to Mars year. We see some years that have just small dust storms and other years that have a pattern of larger storms, and occasionally, one out of every 5 or 6 years or so, we see a big dust storm that affects the whole planet. We haven't seen that in the last 5 years, but we're in the middle of the season where those storms tend to occur, and so we're hopeful we'll catch one in the act, and we'll be able to see how they start and how they change and evolve with time. They make a big difference to the climatology of Mars. When the atmosphere is filled with dust, it's warmer. The surface is actually cooler during the day because the dust shades the surface in effect. But there are many changes on the planet that we're monitoring today. And so that's really the word that sums up. There's change, modern change on Mars today.
Now, the rovers tend to get a lot of the headlines and attention. Of course, Curiosity being the most current mission, the Mars Science Laboratory. And that's in Gale Crater, right?
That's correct.
But I want to ask you, why is having an orbiters so important, not only for conducting science from above, but also for augmenting those roving missions with Spirit, Opportunity, and now Curiosity?
Well, practically every image that you have seen from the surface of Mars, whether from a lander or the rovers, was relayed through an orbiter that was circling overhead. That saves power for the landed asset down on the surface and greatly increases the amount of data that we can send back to Earth from those landed and roving elements. Furthermore, you only get a chance to pick a spot for each of those. And so where on a planet where the land area is the same as the Earth, where do you go? And that's what the orbiters help us do. By looking at the potential for future scientific discovery, is this a place that might have preserved evidence of life in the past? Is it a place that we could investigate habitability or climate change? And then also, the orbiters can tell us, particularly with MROs, very high resolution, are there any hazards down there that we need to avoid, or at least to assess how important it is to go to that particular spot? So both getting data back and showing where the landers ought to go and rovers ought to go. For instance, Gale Crater was picked because from orbit, MRO could see that there were these vast strata of minerals that seemed to indicate a change over time of the climate, going from something that was wetter to drier. Now, once you're down on the surface, of course, the rovers can see things in greater detail than we can from orbit. But a rule of thumb has been that if we see it from orbit, the rovers will see it at the surface, but we don't see everything from orbit. We know that. And that's why we send things to the surface to look in much greater detail.
Let's go back all the way to the beginning of Mars exploration from the 60s on through. Give us a little historical timeline of what we've known about Mars and then put MRO into its place in that timeline.
Well, the history of Mars and our interest in it goes all the way back to the beginning of the century, around 1900s or so, when we thought we saw on Mars evidence of a place that might actually have vegetation on its surface, maybe even canals, a very artificial-looking feature running across it. Since then, our vision of what Mars can and was has changed over time. When the Mariner's spacecraft just flew by the planet, Mariner 6 and 7 and Mariner 4, they saw a very heavily cratered surface. Since then, we've learned that that's the oldest part of Mars, and it's a part, it contains rocks that were formed very early in the planet's history, rocks that on the Earth are actually gone today because they've been recycled by plate tectonics. So Mars may have a bit of history preserve that the Earth does not have. And MRO has been exploiting that by looking at those ancient regions, looking at the diversity of the minerals and the stratification. Where are the layers? Where could those different water environments be? So once again, what we're learning is from MRO is that the planet, it's a complicated place. It's got many environments that may have coexisted at the same time. Water may have come and then gone for periods of time and then come back again. And that may have happened multiple times. We see that evidence preserved in the rocks. And what we're also learning from MRO is that there were ice ages on the planet, and we're getting to the point where we can quantify how long and how long ago that ice may have been forming in the polar caps. So those are things that MRO has done. And then we're also learning the physics of how things happen on Mars today, and that gives us a way of validating our models of how they might have occurred in the past. All those things.
Now, you've mentioned the dark streaks, the lineae, and we now know that that is a briny water, right?
We suspect that. They look that way. However, there's some puzzling measurements that when we look at the temperatures of the ground, it's not quite warm enough. And if there were a lot of water seeping through that surface, it ought to change those measurements in a way that we could measure. So what's the action that's going on here? Ultimately, we may have to get down to the surface to understand them. But before we do that, we're going to continue looking at them from year to year, see what the changes are. Also see how widespread it is. Does it occur in every crater and every steep-walled area? We don't believe so from our observations to date. But by looking at the circumstances of where this occurs, that'll give us a clue as to what it's all about.
I'd like to shift gears for a moment, and we're talking with Rich Zurich, who is a project scientist for Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And I'd like to know about you a little bit personally. How did you first get interested in Mars? And tell us about the arc that led you to becoming not only the chief scientist for MRO, but also the chief scientist for the Mars Program Office at JPL.
Well, I'd always been interested in astronomy and in space. And I came of age when the space race was just getting started with the launch of Sputnik and the U.S. Explorer rockets and such. But it never occurred to me, actually, that that might become a career. I was all the way into graduate school with a background in mathematics, but in a department of atmospheric science at the University of Washington. And they had a new professor there, Conway Leovi, who had been involved in the early Mariner projects and missions. And he had also helped run the first ever model of the Mars atmosphere in the sense of a weather forecast or a general circulation model. And he got me interested again in those things. And since then, I've studied upper atmosphere of the Earth as well as of Mars. They're not so different in terms of pressure and temperature, although a lot more ozone in the Earth's atmosphere, and that's important to life on the planet. And I got involved again in the Mars program at JPL. And, you know, we don't always succeed. I was involved in the Polar Lander and the Mars Climate Orbiter. They were part of a time when NASA was trying to do things faster, better, and cheaper. And we probably went too cheap in those regards. Both missions were lost, and I was determined, along with many others, to get those measurements back. And that led to the design and concept and eventual implementation of the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been very successful, has recovered those observations and done much, much more. So you never quite know what the curve of one's trajectory will be. And when your interest and when you can make your vocation and advocation one in the same. I've been very lucky in that regard.
What are some of the things that if you could go back in time, what advice would you give yourself to help you unraveling the secrets of the red planet? If you could go back 20, 30 years and tell yourself what you know now, what would be a tip you would give younger yourself?
Well, there are two. One is, pay more attention to the big picture in the sense of, does this data make sense given this other data? And also to be more careful about what we assume when we look at something. Mars is interesting in that you can look at a picture of the planet and you see a landform, for instance, and you go, I know what that is. That's a gully. That's like on Earth. And then you realize the spatial scale of it, it's 10 times bigger. And how do you do that? Is that because it's less gravity? Is that because there was more water at one time? You know, to be less sort of Earth-centric in taking a look at a new planet and open to new ideas and such. We make progress better that way.
Now, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the rovers are all part of an ongoing program with the eventual goal of, you know, putting actual human footprints on Mars. What are some of the things that you're doing with this mission that will help us in the future in terms of human exploration of Mars?
Well, one concept for the way that humans would explore Mars once they're on the surface is that they'll go to something called an exploration zone, an area that's maybe 200 kilometers across, 120 miles or so. And they'll go there repeatedly. So you need to find those places that are particularly compellingly interesting and such from the standpoint of future discovery. You also need to find some resources that those explorers could use. And one of those, of course, is water itself. That water might be in the form of hydrated minerals, might be in the form of shallow ice. But right now, that's what Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter looks for, is it examines potential landing sites for those future explorers, tries to show whether or not resources are local and accessible, tries to show what exploration might be done once the humans were down there on the surface and operating vehicles or driving across the surface or walking and exploring in detail. So looking for those landing sites, just as we've done for the robotic missions, is what we're doing right now for those future human missions.
You're listening to Blue Dot on NSPR, and we're talking to Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter project scientist Rich Zurich. And I'd like to shift gears just a little bit to talk about the discovery of that possible briny water on Mars has also led to some speculation that there may actually be, in fact, microbial life there now at or below the surface. And that raises implications for surface exploration, perhaps before we get humans there, in terms of not contaminating Mars with Earth-born organisms so that we can know these are actually Martian organisms. Could you explain to us what kind of protocols NASA uses to try to make sure we have a chance to actually discover those Martian microbes are from Mars and not from Earth?
So planetary protection is what we call the collection of policies and protocols that do several things. One is we want to make sure that we don't contaminate the Earth if we bring samples of Mars back or humans back in the future and such, that we know what we're dealing with. The other is we don't want to inadvertently contaminate Mars. Now, that's hard to do. You can't completely sterilize things, and certainly when humans go to the planet, we're going to be bringing other bioburden, as we like to call it, to the planet. But if we know what it is, then we can also get around the problem of, hey, we thought we discovered Mars life, but it turns out they were Earth bugs instead, or Earth microbes there. And by knowing what we're taking, and by trying to reduce and keep as clean as possible what we do, that's what we do. For the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, for instance, what we did is we both tried to keep it as clean as possible, which meant that you scrub down certain parts of the surface, you heat sterilize some areas and such. But it's also designed, and the mission is designed, in a way that it, when the orbiter is no longer able to respond to our commands and such, may enter the atmosphere, it'll burn up and break up rather than contaminate the planet with large injection of Earth microbes, possibly, and such. Looking for life on the surface of Mars is kind of interesting because our Viking experience said, hey, there's something here that removes carbon generally, whether it's part of biology, biological systems or not. And that's the ultraviolet radiation that comes down through that thin atmosphere, which has very little oxygen. It's mostly carbon dioxide, and therefore little ozone, which screens out that extreme ultraviolet radiation here on the Earth. So we're expecting those microbes might be deep in the crust. Deep here means maybe just more than a meter down into the ground and such. And we can look for that or look for evidence of that in places that have been freshly exposed. Where are the places that are being eroded away that may have been protected from that ultraviolet radiation? Some of those we might keep as special areas and zones that we protect so that we can continue to explore whether or not there's Mars life on the planet, even once there is Earth life, which will be us and our future explorers going down to the surface.
What about your job most inspires you, or what do you most get excited about going to work every day?
To see a new world is just such a rush. To look at it for the first time and to look at it as a whole planet, to get to see different aspects of it. You know, we're not just doing a piece of the geology or a piece of the meteorology and atmospheric science. You get to think about the whole planet and how it's changed over time. But I must say that one of the most satisfying things about working in the space program is to work with a bunch of really talented people who are working very hard in an atmosphere of give and take, where you try out ideas, you assess them, you move on, you solve the problems, and you're doing it in the common cause of this exploration. That is really a fun thing.
Now, there may be someone out there that listens to this program that could potentially really actually be the first person to set foot on Mars. It's quite possible that that's this young generation now. What advice would you give them to metaphorically walk in your footsteps to get to that point?
Be prepared. Be prepared for opportunities that you may not anticipate. When I was back in graduate school and went to the Department of Atmospheric Science, I didn't know that I was going to have an opportunity to embrace my interest of space exploration, but I was prepared with the mathematical and physical education backgrounds that I had. So be prepared. But the other one is, you know, chase your dream there, because space exploration has been a magnet. Exploration in general has been a magnet to peoples of the Earth and such. And Mars is that next horizon that we want to go look over.
Rich, thank you.
My pleasure.
That was Rich Zurich, project scientist for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and head of the Mars Program Office at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Well, Nolan, the Reconnaissance Orbiter is just an amazing spacecraft. And so the discoveries they make from orbit augment so well what they're doing on the surface that I think it's been an interesting program of exploration. And it's hard to believe that it's been a decade that's been going on.
Yes, and it's interesting to think that somebody out there listening might be the first person to step on Mars.
That is very possible. They could be listening to this program right now. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Visit us at mynspr.org. Follow us on Twitter at NSPRNews and me at Dave Shlom. For my cohort, Nolan Ford, the guy who does the heavy lifting on this show, I also want to thank Guy Webster from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena for lining up our guests in studio there. And until next time, I'm reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.